Hey, listeners. Thanks for dropping in. I'm Christy.
And I'm Melissa. And this is Buried Motives, where we dig deep into the details of some of the most gruesome
dirtbag murderers.
Hey, listeners.
Welcome back to Buried Motives.
We are glad you're joining us this week.
Yes, thank you for joining.
We're happy you're here, and I'm happy to hear Christy's case.
Well, and I'm...
happy to tell it?
Well, I don't know if I can say happy, because it's never great to talk about someone's murder, but I am very curious what you'll feel about this case.
Is it a controversial one?
Not really, but it does involve a child.
Oh, well, I already know how I feel. I hate it. I hate this guy, Christy.
Well, this guy is also a child.
Oh.
We have covered a few cases where the dirtbag we discuss is a child, and today is going to be one of those cases. But this kid might be one of the most unnerving killer kids that we have covered so far. He blatantly told officers that he had no remorse for killing his friend and was wanting to kill another. This boy obsessed over serial killers and all things horror, until he became so desensitized that it no longer became one of those things that he would never do. In fact, it became something that he really wanted to do. He did not black out and kill his friend in a fit of rage. He meticulously planned out his actions and was so confident that he was going to get away with it that he already had two more victims picked out because he knew he needed at least three to gain serial killer status.
How old is this kid?
14.
Wow, that's so young.
It really is.
You already be wanting to be a serial killer.
And his background isn't the type that would make you predict that he would become this way either.
Oh, I hate those anomalies. They just don't sit well with me.
No, and that is definitely what this case is. Today's murderer didn't have a rough upbringing. He came from an affluent neighborhood. His parents loved him. He was a gifted student and had friends who cared about him.
Oh yeah, this is not adding up.
No. This is definitely a case where you will be questioning where everything went wrong. It is an example of how hindsight is often 20/20, and it can be hard to see what is happening right in front of us until it is too late.
So there were no warning signs?
There were a few looking back, but at the time, they didn't seem that bad.
But in hindsight, it's like glaringly obvious.
I'll let you decide. The parents thought, oh, he's just becoming this teenage boy because he was just turning 14. So for him to pull away or change his interests, they're thinking, yeah, he's becoming a teenager.
Oh, that would make sense at that time frame.
Yeah.
Because kids do change their personalities a little bit.
They do. They're going through a lot when they're hitting that age. They're trying to figure out who they are. They don't want to do the same old things that they perceived as being a baby anymore. So there definitely was an escalation, but I don't know if it was so in your face, something's wrong.
Right. It was something easy to chalk up to something else.
Exactly.
Okay. You have me intrigued.
Okay, because that's what you're in for today. Michael Hernandez was born on February 2nd, 1990 to Kathy and Jesus Hernandez. Kathy Hernandez was an occupational therapist, and Jesus was a business owner of a consignment store. Jesus and Kathy did well for themselves. They lived in a nice upper-middle-class neighborhood in South Florida. The couple also had a daughter born prior to their son being born. Michael was extremely smart and was attending Southwood Middle School at 16301 Southwest 80th Avenue, a school for gifted children in Palmetto Bay in Miami-Dade County. He was only in grade 8 at the time of the murder. Michael started out like many other children in America. He was outgoing, he was inquisitive, and he loved baseball. Eventually, there were small changes in Michael's behavior that his parents just saw as quirks. However, in the months leading up to the murder, Kathy and Jesus had been making plans for their son to begin seeing a psychologist. It was one of those things that hadn't happened yet, which is so relatable. Like I said, hindsight in this case was much clearer than what they saw on a day-to-day basis. Michael began to exhibit classic OCD, or obsessive-compulsive disorder, behavior. He said he was self-diagnosed as having OCD. In Michael's world, there was a place for everything and everything had to be in its place. Even when Michael was young, he had to make his bed each morning and liked his clothes put away in color coordination.
Okay, I have to say that I would totally be counting that in the win zone.
Yeah, you would not be thinking that that's a red flag.
No. Did he become really upset if he couldn't do those things or if his clothes weren't in color coordination?
I don't think it ever came up that it wasn't, because why would you go against that if your child liked his clothes to be in order?
Yeah, and put away neatly.
Yeah, he liked a clean room. He didn't like things left out in his room and preferred minimal decorations in his room. I saw photos of his closet and it was meticulous. All his shirts were hung in groups of colors. Not what you'd expect from a typical teenage boy.
Oh, but it's sounding so fabulous to me.
Right? Michael did engage in some repetitive behaviors. He would shut and open the garage door for a specific amount of times before coming into the house, and would open the fridge and look at its contents in a specific way each time. It was a side-by-side fridge, so he would open both doors together and systematically look from left to right over and over. When he sat at the dinner table, all the knives had to be facing in his direction. For us, this may seem weird, but I think it is different when this is just how it's always been. It's Michael being Michael. Other repetitions included having the same specifically made sandwich for lunch at school every day and watching their grandfather clock at the same time of the day for a specific amount of time.
Okay, these are a little odd, Christy.
Yes.
But I get your point about how if it just developed a little bit at a time, over time, you wouldn't necessarily realize how odd it had become.
Right. And his parents did feel like, okay, we think our son has OCD. We need to get him in to see a psychologist. But life is busy and they just hadn't made that happen yet.
It was on the to-do list.
Yes. And anyone who is a parent knows how long that list can get. However, Michael's interests slowly began to shift and he stopped doing things that he once loved. He lost interest in baseball, not even wanting to watch the Miami Marlins win the World Series in 2003, the year before the murder. He stopped wanting to play basketball in the driveway, and he quit his car wash hustle that he did to earn extra money, something he was passionate enough about to make flyers to advertise his business. Some of Michael's change in his behavior also included him pulling away. He didn't talk to his parents as much as he used to, and avoided eye contact a lot of the time. All this being said, Michael's parents chalked a lot of his changing behavior up to him becoming a teenager. How many teenagers pull away for a time and lose interest in things that they once loved? Michael's mother, Kathy, said, quote, "The changes we saw in Michael, we thought were age appropriate." She described his behavior as, quote, "things we thought were normal teenage types of things." Kathy and Jesus said they still had a loving relationship with their son. He would still kiss his mom goodnight. Michael might have lost interest in some of the things that he used to find enjoyment in, but he replaced those activities and interests with other things. One of those things was bodybuilding, which again isn't unusual for a teenage boy to become interested in that. Michael became obsessive, though, about his physical health and started a grueling and strict workout and diet regimen. His main goal was to lose weight. He would write out his rigid workout plan, follow it precisely, and then check those exercises off from his list as he went along. He was definitely a list maker and a list checker.
There's nothing wrong with that, Christy.
Who doesn't enjoy crossing something off their list? I definitely do. On top of his workouts, no matter what, he would go on a lengthy bike ride every day after eating dinner. Michael started taking whey powder to bulk up, and then finally, about a month before the murder, he convinced his parents to buy him creatine. I read in one report in the Tampa Bay Times that he started taking close to 3 to 4 times the recommended dosage for his body weight.
It can really upset your stomach, Christy.
Yeah. And what I read is there's not a whole lot of testing that's been done on how this can affect a growing child's body. It's mostly for adults. A lot of this beginning information I got from the Tampa Bay Times, which was great because it wasn't easy to find. Every day, Michael would eat the same snack. He would sit in the same chair in the living room and treat himself to yogurt and sugar-free Jell-O. Michael didn't just schedule exactly what he would eat and what he would do to exercise. He soon began scheduling out every moment of every day, down to the minute for the entire 24 hours of each day. He would bring his agenda that he had created to school and follow it strictly. He even penciled in the time that he would chat with friends. He wanted complete control of his life and wanted everything in it to be perfect.
That's not going to end well for him.
It's not. Because as we all know, having everything go perfectly during your day is impossible. And so when things wouldn't work out exactly as he wanted, this would only fuel him to obtain even more control. The second thing that Michael appeared to become obsessed over was violence. He began listening to extremely graphic and violence-depicting music. He also became preoccupied by horror movies and true crime. He was enthralled by serial killers, and he loved reading books and watching movies by Stephen King. At the time of his arrest, there was a videotape of the miniseries by Stephen King titled Storm of the Century by the TV in his room. This story is about a serial killer who was able to continue killing telepathically from behind bars by possessing the minds of townspeople to kill each other or take their own lives.
Is it wrong that I kind of want to read that book?
I think we should.
But it's an interesting read for a 14-year-old.
Right. And he had become so obsessed over everything horror. Mm. He wasn't watching anything else or reading anything else.
All about balance.
Mm-hmm. As great as Stephen King is in the horror world, there was one movie franchise that took the cake for Michael. The infamous Silence of the Lambs movies.
That one is so creepy.
It is. But so fantastic. It is really a good series. But Michael was not only enthralled by the character of cannibal killer, Dr. Hannibal Lecter. He was also fascinated by the deranged serial killer in the movie named Buffalo Bill, whose character was based on Ed Gein, who we've actually covered. As I said, these are great movies, but it is surprising how often they come up in these cases that we discuss. Just a little side note here, that one time I did watch all of the Silence of the Lambs movies, one per night in a row, and it was really great to watch it that way.
And then she didn't sleep for the next five.
No, I slept fine. Melissa wouldn't have slept for the next five. But watching it that way, I noticed so many more connecting things from movie to movie. So I highly recommend you do that if you can. Just don't become obsessed like Michael did.
I don't know if I could.
Oh, it was great. Because when you wait a year or two in between movies coming out, unless you've just recently watched the previous one, you forget some of those little details. So it was really well done how it interconnected each of the movies, in my opinion.
They unsettle me. Like, I like watching them. They're interesting, but they unsettle me. So I need a couple nights in between.
No, I watched one night in a row downstairs in my basement all by myself before I went to bed, eating my popcorn, just enjoying.
Bedtime stories for Christy.
Yep. I think a lot of our listeners listen to true crime as they fall asleep, so it's not that weird. Once you get a little scared, that's okay too.
If I did that, I would not sleep. I don't mind studying or listening to true crime when I'm awake and there's lights and the sun is up.
The birds are chirping.
And the world tells me it's all safe.
It's true. And a lot of people actually have a harder time with horror movies than they do true crime.
Because it's visual.
I don't know. I don't know what the difference is.
I find true crime worse than actual horror movies because it actually happened.
Yeah, it should be worse.
Yeah.
But Michael liked it all. Eventually, Michael became so intrigued by murder that he became fixated on becoming a serial killer. He became desensitized by it. And in Michael's eyes, it started to become a normal thing that some people just do. Michael got a notebook and started jotting down his thoughts, which evolved into a plan for murder. Much like how he wrote down his workout schedule, he also meticulously wrote out who he was going to kill and exactly how he was going to do it. We will come back to this notebook during the trial, and I will share more details about what he wrote specifically. It's unnerving.
That would be so eerie to find after the fact.
Yes. And it's not a small notebook. They find a lot of information. He was a busy boy filling that out. Kathy and Jesus had noticed some of these quirks evolving in their son. They had a family member, I believe it was a niece, who was officially diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder, and they recognized many of the same symptoms in their teenage son. And it can be a hereditary type of thing.
But that would almost give them another false sense of, oh, this is normal. Like somebody else has it, so this isn't that bad.
Exactly, yes. Gave them an explanation, which maybe lessened their urgency to get him help.
Right.
However, it wasn't any one giant red flag. It was a combination of all the little things and the rate at which his fixations were growing in intensity and in numbers that was concerning. Michael's parents approached him about seeing a psychologist, but he expressed that he wasn't crazy about the idea and basically told his dad that the psychologist couldn't assess him if he didn't talk to them. Michael's mother did make the appointment, but unfortunately, he didn't end up going and help would come too late. Her son would go on to become a murderer before she was able to get him to an appointment. And I do want to say zero negativity or judgment to Michael's parents. Unless we've been there, we can't truly understand. and they hadn't witnessed any real disturbing tendencies being displayed by their son at this point, but they were there. Michael had decided that he wanted to start killing people. He wrote out his plan and chose his victims. Next, he had to decide when he would put his sinister plan into action, and he came up with what he thought would be the perfect date, his birthday.
Oh, I was going to say Friday the 13th?
Nope, his birthday. So kind of like a little birthday present to himself. Like, yes, I will remember this well because it'll be a celebration for me.
Oh, that's disturbing.
Isn't it? Michael was turning 14 on February 2nd, 2004. He went to school that day prepared to take the lives of two of his best friends. I saw a picture of his action plan that he made. It is written very scholarly. It said planning at the top for the title. The next three lines at the top were written out like you would expect for an experiment almost. One line was for the date. The next line was for victims, followed by his two friends' names. And the third line was listed as materials. On this line, he wrote hat, jacket, knife, gloves, tape. The rest of the document had an 8-step plan on what to do. These steps included how he was going to kill them and what he was going to do afterwards. Michael's plan was to lure his friends to the bathroom and get them to go into one of the stalls. Once inside, he was going to get them to turn around so he could kill them. He would then collect his evidence and leave the bodies propped up on the toilets. He wrote to be quote-unquote quick and remove all blood. For step 7, Michael wrote, quote, make sure they are dead. Make sure there is no one in the bathrooms. If so, kill them. His last step started out with, quote, thank God for success.
What?
Yeah. It is so disturbing seeing this written out in a child's handwriting. Michael had been raised in a religious family, and it was just so shocking to read that he would want to thank God that his plan was successful.
He is delusional.
Very. Thankfully, Michael's plan did not pan out the way that he wanted it to on February 2nd, but not because he didn't try. Michael's two best friends at the time were boys in his grade, 13-year-old Andre Martin and 14-year-old Jaime Goff. One would survive and the other sadly would not. Jaime's name is spelt like Jamie, but I believe it is pronounced as Jaime. In some videos, he is referred to as Jamie, even by police, Andre, and Michael. So I think he went by Jamie with his friends. I am assuming this is what he wanted his friends to call him, so I will refer to him as Jamie during our case, but just note that it is properly pronounced as Jaime. Andre would later say that Michael was almost like the leader of their social group. Whatever Michael said or suggested was what the trio did. Andre described Michael as having a, quote, very magnetic personality. Michael was popular and people were drawn to him. On the morning of his birthday, Michael met up with his two besties, Andre and Jamie, as per usual. Andre noticed that Michael was wearing a red windbreaker over his white t-shirt. This was unusual for Michael to wear a jacket. Andre said that Michael never wore warm clothing. And I had to remind myself that this was in Florida. Because here you would be wearing warm clothing a lot of the year, if it looked cool or not.
I don't know about that. My kid, he wears slides in the middle of the winter.
That's true. And I have seen some kids walking to school in shorts.
Yep.
Not during a polar vortex, which we sometimes get. Michael told Jamie and Andre that he wanted to show them something inside the school. Andre said that this seemed a little weird, but he trusted his friends, so he went along with it. Before school was to start, Michael led his two friends into the boys' bathroom on the second floor of the school. Michael walked to the back wall of the bathroom and took out a baseball hat from the front pocket of his windbreaker and put it on. Michael told Andre that he had to show him something, but that he needed to come into the stall to see it. About this, Andre later said in an interview, quote, one of the things I think about to this day, and it almost gives me goosebumps, was once we entered the bathroom, his face changed completely.
My countenance changed?
It did.
How many times do we hear about that?
So much.
That it actually looks like a physical change.
Mm-hmm.
Just evil.
It is definitely evil. And that, you're right, we have heard it many times, that this look of evil just comes over them. Andre continued to say, a look came into his eyes. It was just a blank stare, as if, you know, there was a job that needed to be done.
He's taskmaster now.
Mm-hmm. Andre was very uncomfortable with what his friend was asking. He questioned Michael about what he would need to show him inside the stall and asked him to just show him in the main part of the bathroom, Michael said no, it had to be inside the stall. Andre hesitated. It wasn't sitting right with him. He knew something was wrong. He said a heavy gut feeling came upon him, telling him that this was not right. And right after that, his mind was filled with reasons to be concerned based on Michael's escalating behavior. He said he actually thought about how much he likes serial killers and horror movies and all these things.
Oh, that is a freaky premonition.
It definitely was. So he wasn't willing to go in.
Good for him for listening to his instincts.
Yes. It saved his life. Jamie sensed the reluctance of his friend and offered to go first. But Michael said no, it had to be Andre who went first. Remember, he had written this out meticulously.
Yeah, he didn't like things out of order.
No. At this point, the boys were literally saved by the bell. The school bell rang and the boys hurried off to class. Michael instructed his friends to meet him at the same place, same time the following day, so he could show them what he was wanting to. Andre and Jamie agreed. As they were leaving the bathroom, Michael said, quote, "Tomorrow is going to be a special day."
But it wouldn't be his birthday anymore.
It wouldn't. And nothing about the following day would be special. This time, Jamie would not be saved, and Michael would be successful in carrying out part of his devious plan. The next morning, Tuesday, February 3rd, 2004, Michael got up and grabbed the kill kit that he had taken to school with him the previous day. Inside his school backpack, he had made a secret compartment. He cut open the inside lining of the pack to hide a knife in, and then used Velcro to shut the opening so it wouldn't be noticeable. He also packed two pairs of latex gloves and tape. Michael later admitted that he got his mother to purchase the latex gloves from Walgreens the night before the killing. He told her that he needed them for an extra credit assignment in his science class. So as a caring mother does, she went and got them for her son. And I just thought, how sick to your stomach would you feel later to find out that your son had tricked you into purchasing gloves for him that he intended to use in a murder?
Yeah, that would be bad.
This also reiterated to me that this killer was a child. He was too young to just hop in the car and go get them himself. Michael also tricked his father into helping him prepare for the murder. He told his father that he was interested in collecting knives, and so his dad let him keep some of the knives that he had at his consignment store. He had quite the collection.
It just shows how supportive his parents are.
They totally were. Michael arrived at the school early in anticipation. He was determined to kill someone one way or the other. The school doors didn't open until 8:50, but he had gotten there just before 8:30. He snuck into the bathroom and waited for his friends.
How did he get into the school if the school doors didn't open?
There was a door kind of near the back, I believe, that was unlocked.
Oh, okay.
He snuck into the bathroom and waited for his friends. He was expecting both to show up. Sadly, Jamie did show up, just as he had promised his friend that he would.
Being a good friend.
He was. Andre, on the other hand, had completely forgotten. He was part of an extracurricular group and was one of the officers of that group. On this particular morning, he was discussing things with his peers concerning their group. Meeting up with Michael and Jamie simply slipped his mind. An oversight that would ultimately spare him his life. Andre says that he believes that this happening was an act of God because he had every intention of meeting his friends that morning.
Does he have a lot of survivor guilt?
I don't think as much that he has survivor guilt. I think it was more the realization of, I need to make something of my life. Almost like I got a second chance.
Mm.
And he really does. And we will talk about what he ends up doing later.
It's hard to believe that he wasn't protected.
Definitely. The universe definitely intervened. Michael waited for Andre to show up, but feeling pressed for time, he decided to go ahead with his plan without him and just target Jamie. He would have to kill Andre later. So I think he was thinking to himself, this didn't work out last time. I have to make it happen today. I can't wait another day.
Feeling more pressure.
Yeah. Michael was again wearing his red windbreaker. He purposefully chose this article of clothing to aid him in cleaning up afterwards. He knew the windbreaker material would prevent blood from getting on his shirt and could be easily removed and concealed afterwards. And I purposely think that he chose red to help the blood be less noticeable.
So smart.
He really is. It's just sad that this went to waste. He wore a hat to help prevent hair follicles from being left at the crime scene. I'm going to summarize the account of what happens next from one of Michael's court documents, as well as add some things from his taped confession that he gave afterwards. In the court document, it states that Michael coaxed Jamie into the handicap stall, I assume so that he would have more room. Once in the stall together, Michael locked the door so Jamie could not get out easily. He told Jamie to turn away from him. He then pulled out his gravity knife from his right front pocket that he had gotten from his father. A gravity knife is a folded knife intended to be able to be opened with one hand, but it is different from a spring-propelled switchblade. There is a mechanism that you do press for the gravity knife, but it uses gravity to help open the knife. The mechanism just releases the blade from the handle in the closed position. This knife had a 4-inch serrated blade. Michael then reached around with his left hand and placed his hand on Jamie's mouth. With his right hand, he made several cuts with the blade from left to right across Jamie's throat. Jamie tried to resist and sustained cuts to the pads of his index and middle fingers of his right hand. During the attack, Michael caused an incision 4 to 5 inches in length that opened Jamie's windpipe and severed both jugular veins. He continued to stab Jamie in the head and neck. To make sure his friend was dead, Michael pressed his knife into Jamie's face and scalp. He then checked his eyes to make sure that they were motionless. Michael wasted no time after brutally murdering his friend. He immediately sprung into action to carry out the next step of his plan. He flushed the pair of latex gloves that he was wearing down the toilet and put on the second pair to commence his cleanup. He washed his hands and face and as much blood off of his jacket as he could. He put the jacket into his backpack and hid the murder weapon in the secret compartment that he had made. As he was finishing washing his hands, another student entered the bathroom. When this boy entered the bathroom, he could immediately see through the large mirror the reflection of someone collapsed in a toilet stall with a huge pooling of blood on the floor. I saw crime scene photos of an aerial shot of the bathroom stall floor where Jamie was found, and listeners, I literally gasped when I first saw it. When I say it pooled, it was a pool of blood, and hauntingly, Jamie's glasses laid in the thick of it. The photos are both disturbing and heartbreaking. The student who entered the bathroom asked Michael if he saw the body, and Michael replied to him, quote, "Yes, we should tell somebody." As this student ran to tell the school security guard, Michael casually went to his first class of the day. It was said that he acted like he typically did. He was not visibly shaken by what had just happened. He was even laughing and joking with the other students.
Why wouldn't he have pretended to find him too?
Nope, he just went to class as if nothing happened.
Obviously, they're going to come and suspect him if he is found in the bathroom with them.
I don't know if this kid recognized who Michael was, but he does get found out another way. Michael asked to be excused from class to use the washroom, and the teacher allowed him to leave and come back. I read that this happened a couple of times, but I couldn't confirm, nor do I know what exactly he was doing when he left the room. I think maybe he was trying to spy on the situation.
He wanted to see his handiwork.
Yeah, or did they find him yet? What's happening? Just more curious. Not too long afterwards, there was an announcement over the school's PA system stating that there was a lockdown. You can imagine the panic that set in once staff came to realize what had just taken place inside their prestigious school for gifted students. Police immediately dispatched to the scene and teachers were notified of what had happened. The students were just told that a student was found dead in the school, but were not told initially that he was murdered. Michael had come into class late, and it was noticed that he had some blood on his white t-shirt and shoes. He gave a phony story on how this happened. He said that Jamie had pushed open a door and accidentally hit Michael in the mouth, causing him to bleed.
But he didn't have a mark on his lip?
No. And he was essentially saying that it was his own blood and it was because of Jamie. Thankfully, his teacher wasn't buying it. If you had a student with fresh blood on his shirt and then learned that another student had just been stabbed to death, hopefully you would make the same connection as this teacher.
Well, you totally would.
Police were able to very quickly discover the blood-soaked windbreaker, a bloody latex glove, and the gravity knife in his backpack. He was subsequently taken into police custody. In the state of Florida, a minor does not have to have a parent present for the police to speak to, question, and even detain them.
That's surprising.
I found that interesting. Michael was questioned by police. At first, he lied and blamed it on an older student in a gang and said it happened because Jamie owed this kid money. However, later that same day, he waived his Miranda right and confessed to everything.
All without his parents present.
I did not see his parents in the interrogation video. This interview is available to watch online, and it is chilling to hear just how matter-of-factly that Michael speaks about his actions. I'm going to share a few of his responses during this interview as he gives more detail about the murder and how he feels about it. Michael told the investigator that he got Jamie into the stall by telling him that he had something to show him. Once in the stall, Michael took out the gloves and put them on. Jamie asked him what he was doing, and Michael said that he just liked the way that they felt. Michael then tells Jamie to turn around because he wants it to be a surprise. With Jamie's back towards him, he first tells him that he has to put his hand over his mouth, and trusting his friend, Jamie lets him. I cannot imagine what was going through Jamie's mind at this time. With his hand over Jamie's mouth, Michael was able to lift Jamie's head upwards to expose his neck and attack. Badly injured, Jamie turned around and begged his friend not to kill him. Michael said he told Jamie, quote, "Okay, I'm not going to if you cooperate." Michael admits to the officer, quote, "That was a lie."
Oh, man.
So brutal.
So cold-hearted.
Yes, this is his friend.
Was he able to create attachments?
Yeah, I believe that he did.
So how do you do this to your friend?
I don't know. I really don't know.
Unless he's just viewing it as a task, and that's just the task that needs to be done. So he's detached from it, obviously.
Yes. And he had said it was easier for him to kill a friend, basically, because it was easier to get that person into the stall with him.
Right, because they trusted him.
Yes. After telling his friend that he wasn't going to kill him, Michael stabbed Jamie a total of 41 times, mostly in the neck and once in the temple. He also admitted to poking him in the face with the point of the knife to make sure he was dead. The investigator point-blankly asked Michael if he knows the difference between right and wrong. Michael answers, quote, "Yes, I do." He then asks him, quote, "Do you think what you did is right or wrong?" Michael answers, quote, "No, I don't." To clarify, Michael says, "I think it's neither right, but I don't think it was wrong." He then asks, quote, "Are you sorry that this happened today?" And Michael responds coldly, quote, "No, I'm not." He sounded like he was actually proud of what he did. The person typing out the interview had to request Michael to slow down. He was getting excited and talking too fast for them to keep up. Michael told police that he was friends with Jamie and that they had been friends since the seventh grade. When asked why he chose Jamie, he said that he knew Jamie would follow him. Michael also admitted that he had wanted to kill his friend Andre as well. They had been friends since elementary school. Before we get into the trial and investigation, let me tell you a little bit more about Jamie. I showed Melissa a picture of Jamie, and photos of him honestly melt my heart.
His picture just looks the sweetest.
He really is. He looks like he was the most pure and innocent soul. And from what I read about him, it seems like he really was. Jamie Rodrigo Goff was born on October 10th, 1989, in Miami-Dade County, Florida, to parents George and Maria Goff. Jamie's father, George, immigrated from Panama and at the time worked the 3-to-11 shift as a dockhand at the Grove Isles Marina. He cleaned boats and took care of the office duties. Jamie's mother, Maria, immigrated from El Salvador and also worked at the marina cleaning condominiums and yachts. When Jamie would get a day off from school, he loved going to work with his parents. It was thought by the marina staff that Jamie wanted to be a marine biology major. And being a straight-A student, he had the smarts to do it. The following year, Jamie was set to attend one of America's top magnet programs, meaning a school with specialized courses or curricula. Almost every article that I read about Jamie said that he was sweet, smart, and shy. One of his friends' father said about Jamie, quote, "He wasn't outspoken, but if you spoke to him, he was always polite. He often hung out at the house to play video games, and they used to do homework together." Jamie enjoyed playing on the computer, he was interested in Japanese swords, and liked the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, a fact that he kept to himself because he was worried other kids would make fun of him for it.
Aw, Ninja Turtles rock!
They do. They still do. He had also started a fitness program at the local YMCA to help shed some of his quote-unquote baby fat. Jamie played the violin and was involved in the performing arts department of his school. He was described as a happy and fun person. He loved animals, but most of all, he was close to his family. They were very close. Jamie was George and Maria's only son. I'm unsure if he had any sisters. When Maria learned of her son's death, she collapsed and had to be rushed to the hospital. Hearing the news of what happened wasn't easy for Michael's parents either. This was a tragedy all around. It was hard even for the community and the other students to face. When police discovered Michael to have the murder weapon and other items with Jamie's blood on it on his person, they were able to quickly get a warrant to search his home. Inside his room, they discovered his journal that had his sinister plan, amongst other disturbing things written in it. This is the book that I told you about earlier. With evidence stacked against him, Michael waived his rights to a juvenile court. He was charged with first-degree murder. It was abundantly clear that Jamie's murder was premeditated. This wasn't a heat-of-the-moment snap. It was also very clear that Michael had intended to kill Andre. Realizing that their son was facing life in prison, the Hernandezes hired an attorney who had experience helping teenage killers get reduced sentences. Richard Rosenbaum had managed to get teenage killer Lionel Tate a reduced sentence and eventual release when he was found guilty at the age of 12 of murdering his six-year-old neighbor, Tiffany Eunuch, in 1999. Rosenbaum was a firm believer that no child should ever be locked up for the rest of their life.
I wonder if his sentiment is shared by a lot of people.
I get where he's coming from, but I don't necessarily agree with him. I think some people do need to be locked up for life. I think Michael is one of those people. His argument is that instead of locking them up for life, let's get them help and get them rehabilitated.
Right.
We're going to talk about it, but I don't feel like Michael ever has made any signs of being rehabilitated. We'll see what you think. Michael's sinister journal was permitted to be used in court. Astonishingly, 41 pages of that notebook were released by the state attorney general's office and were printed in the Miami Herald.
No way.
Yes. I was so shocked.
41 pages.
Yes.
That's a big newspaper that day.
Yep. At first, the two pages that specifically outlined the murder were withheld, but that was eventually additionally printed, making the page total 43. Video of parts of his tape confession were also released.
That is shocking for a minor.
It really is.
Like, it's shocking for an adult, but that's really, really shocking for a minor.
Yes, but he had waived his right to a juvenile court.
Still shocking.
It is. I was surprised too. In these pages, Michael wrote of his ambition to become a serial killer and eventually commit a mass murder. It also stated that he initially wanted to strangle Andre with a belt and then stab him in the back. Also in Michael's journal was 6 pages printed out about mass, spree, and serial murderers. Beside this, he drew a picture of a hanging man and wrote, quote, "will become a serial killer." In his book, Michael compiled a list of violent video games and movies. He had instructions on how to make a bomb, a detonator, and a Molotov cocktail. That's one of those flaming glass bottles that you see in the movies all the time. On top of all of this, he had even drawn a swastika image with the words white power written on it.
No way.
Yeah.
What a dirtbag.
He really is a dirtbag. Next, he wrote, quote, "You will be a serial killer and mass murderer. Stay along. Never forget God, ever. Have a cult and plan mass kidnapping for New World. Be an expert thief."
Were these like little affirmations for himself?
Yeah, he wrote everything down about his life and his goals, and this was part of it.
It's just wild. Why is he picking up these views? Where had he been introduced to them?
I don't know. He was just kind of obsessed over violence. We'll get into it, but he does get obsessed with Hitler and all of that.
Mm.
Beside this writing, he drew a picture of a man about to be killed by a suspended blade. This was obviously extremely damning evidence against Michael and made me question if a kid like this should ever be released from prison. Michael's writings were described by forensic and child psychologist Dr. Leonard Haber as, quote, "cold, calculated, and demonic."
It sounds like he would have a lot of reforming to do.
Definitely, which he doesn't get. Shockingly, also in this journal was the name of Michael's intended third victim, his 19-year-old sister, Christina, who was away at college at the time. He wanted his sister's death to propel him to serial killer status.
So he was like saving her?
I think she wasn't home from college yet. And so he's like, I'll get these two done and then she'll be my third one and I will be a serial killer.
Did he not like his sister?
We'll talk about that in a bit. But no, there was no visible animosity between the two.
Huh.
But we're talking about a kid who literally murdered one of his best friends.
That doesn't seem like he had a lot of attachment going on.
Unsurprisingly, the judge ordered both sides, to find psychologists to assess Michael to see if he was competent to stand trial. Michael's first competency hearing took place in November of 2004. Psychologist Dr. Vanessa Archer and psychiatrist Dr. John Shaw both testified that Michael was competent to stand trial. They said that he did not suffer from paranoid schizophrenia or any other mental illness that could have impacted his competency. The defense was not happy with these findings and requested a second competency hearing. The request was granted, but in September of 2008, Michael was once again deemed competent to stand trial.
He's a smart guy. He knows right from wrong.
He does. He knew exactly what he was doing. More disturbing facts about Michael were revealed once his trial finally started. Unbeknownst to Michael's parents, Michael had previously attacked another student at the school with a screwdriver. He carried a screwdriver around with him in his pocket. During an outdoor sports game, another student was poking fun at Michael, which provoked him to attack this child with a screwdriver. I honestly think he kept it with him as a legal type of weapon. I don't think he really injured this student, and no one made a big deal about it. They just pulled Michael off of this kid, and it wasn't officially reported until after Jamie's murder.
Not even his parents knew about it?
No, his parents didn't.
Oh, you think that's something you'd want to take up with the parents?
I don't know if the school officials even knew. They were sitting out in the grass area watching this. I think it was a football game. And then they got into this tussle. The kids pulled them apart. So I don't think it was even reported.
Okay.
And it's not like this child had gaping wounds from the screwdriver. But that is a red flag. Many people blame Michael's parents for what happened, for missing the signs. Jesus stated, quote, "There was never a profane word out of his mouth. He was never, ever disrespectful to us or anyone else." Community members also stated that he was a nice kid.
It's so unfair for other people to judge. Unless you've been in a situation dealing with this sort of thing, you have no idea how hard it would be.
I totally agree. Kathy later recalled seeing cut marks on the upper arm of her son. But when she questioned him, he said he had scraped his arm on a fence at school. She had been missing the signs. In later reflection, Andre expressed that Michael was likely seeking out attention. He also feels like Michael's struggles were more internal. You couldn't see the changes as much from the outside. He does remember Michael coming to school one day with cut marks on his arm. Michael told Andre he did it so he could feel pain.
I find it an interesting thing because it's a physical way to release pain. Mm-hmm. Internal pain.
It's true. It is a coping mechanism, unfortunately, for some people. Ultimately, after 3.5 hours of deliberating, a jury of 6 women and 6 men found Michael Hernandez guilty of the first-degree murder of Jamie Goff on September 24th, 2008, over 4.5 years after the murder took place.
Honestly, don't know how you could reach any other verdict with all this evidence against him.
No, I would have been shocked if he wasn't found guilty.
Mm-hmm.
He was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole for Jamie's murder, as well as another consecutive term of 30 years for the attempted first-degree murder of Andre Martin. Maria, Jamie's mother, said, quote, "It's horrible what he did to my son." Maria and George admitted that it was hard to sit through the trial and hear what happened to Jamie. George stated, quote, "I thank God for the strength because this is something that is very consuming and I'm still standing. Unfortunately, it's now a tragedy for 2 families.
It's so sad.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so amazing that he actually sees that it's a tragedy for Michael's family as well.
Oh, George and Maria are remarkable. And to support that, George said, quote, "I couldn't be standing here if I did not forgive. I think we all make stupid mistakes in life. It doesn't mean he doesn't have to pay for what he did. I forgave him, and I forgave his parents, too." And I thought, just wow. Michael, now 18, just sat there motionless when the verdict was read. He was taken to the Columbia Correctional Institution Annex, just east of Lake City, Florida. However, we are not quite done. In 2012, the U.S. Supreme Court banned automatic life sentences for juveniles. In 2016, Michael took advantage of this and made a bid for early release. He claimed that he was a changed man. But not all dirtbags are capable of changing any more than a leopard is capable of changing its spots. It was clear that Michael was still a bloodthirsty dirtbag. He had gotten a girlfriend, I believe from creating a profile on loveaprisoner.com, while behind bars.
Don't you so sights, people?
I know.
So crazy.
It will never not blow my mind that these dirtbags can find significant others while imprisoned for murder.
It is shocking.
But I guess it is a good thing because some of their recorded phone conversations were played during his hearing. In these phone calls, Michael tells his girlfriend that he is not able to show emotion. He said that he would have to stab himself in order to show any emotion. In regards to this, a prison employee stated that the only time Michael was seen crying was when his boyfriend in the jail got transferred and Michael missed him.
That is an interesting development.
Right? He wasn't crying over the things that he did, but when his little jail buddy moved away, he was pretty sad. But he told his girlfriend on the outside that, oh, I'd have to stab myself to feel any kind of emotion. But then with him crying about this other inmate leaving, that does show that he could form an attachment.
Mm-hmm.
Michael also reminisced over what could have been and told his girlfriend that if he had been able to become a serial killer, he would have carved a cross into his victims' foreheads and would have removed their eyeballs as his signature move.
Yeah, I'm not thinking this guy is going to reform.
No, not at all. Michael and his girlfriend, who started out as a pen pal, would discuss serial killers and gruesome crimes. When the prosecutor questioned him why, he said he knew his girlfriend was into gory crimes, and so he told her what he thought she wanted to hear. And to this I say, baloney. His obsession and thirst for blood would never cease. His side of the story was that this was his first girl that he had ever spoken to on the phone, and so he was nervous. So again, he's not even really taking accountability. He's saying, because I was a child when I was arrested, I didn't really know how to act around girls. And so I just told her what she wanted to hear. I had to be what she wanted me to be.
On one hand, he's claiming he's so immature, and yet the action that he's claiming innocence for is actually a very mature relationship behavior.
And at this point in time, he's no longer a child.
No.
He's had a lot of time to sit and think about what he did. To me, it just seems disrespectful to say, oh, I'm a changed person, but then talking about what you would like to do if you were a serial killer, if you could have been.
Yeah, he's not changed.
No, not at all. It also came to light that Michael's father not only helped his son set up his dating profile, but he would play for his son violent death metal music about rape and murder for him to listen to during their phone call conversations.
What?
As well as songs about Hitler.
So was his dad a white supremacist too?
I don't think so. I don't know for sure. But defending his son, Jesus just said that one song did not make a man. Because he was questioned, why are you playing these songs for your son?
Yeah, let's not give him any more of those influences.
No, and they played part of the song that he had played for him, like in the court, and it was not nice. Michael said that he had an intellectual appreciation for death metal music.
And that's why his dad was playing it for him.
Yes.
Okay.
The court argued that Michael's, quote, continued interest in violent music and lyrics replicating the horrific murder and attempted murder he committed were directly relevant to his lack of remorse, his indifference to the suffering of the victims and their families, and Hernandez's prospects for rehabilitation.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree.
I do. I agree. No fence sitting in this episode.
Nope.
Andre Martin, the boy who Michael also wanted to kill, testified against him during this hearing. Michael had told his friend Andre that he thought it would be cool to become a serial killer. And when Andre asked him why, he said he didn't have an exact reason. Andre said that he didn't tell anyone because at the age of 13, you don't take this type of thing that seriously. Jesus, Michael's father, testified at this time and asked the court to release his son. He said he had changed and was, quote, a lot better than he was. I say, a lot better is not good enough, in my opinion. And honestly, I don't believe he was a lot better. Not at all.
If idolizing serial killers and wanting to jab people's eyes out and carve your initials in their forehead is a lot better than what they knew him to be before, then I might be able to call baloney on that they didn't see signs of that before. If yeah. This behavior is better.
I think they're just saying, oh, he's improved so much since he's been in jail. They're just desperate to have him released.
Right.
Like I said at the beginning, I'm not casting judgment on Michael's parents, but it does leave a bad taste in your mouth hearing them advocate and make excuses for their son. But again, none of us can say how we would act in that same situation. Perhaps they were in denial.
Right. And they're being coached by a very high power attorney that's telling them these are the things you should say to get your son out.
That is true.
So who knows if they actually felt those things?
Yeah, I never thought of that, but that could be. And they're just wanting to help him.
Right.
In another one of his calls with his father, Michael said that he felt like America had become too politically correct. He also said that America wouldn't be like this if, quote, we had David Duke as president. If you don't know who David Duke is, he was the founder of the Ku Klux Klan in 1975. He is openly a neo-Nazi and an international spokesman for Holocaust denial. He was elected into Louisiana's House of Representatives and was almost elected governor. This was the type of man that Michael believed should run the United States of America.
That is an interesting role model to choose.
Mm-hmm. Prison staff also testified against Michael's release. Michael had been disciplined for having two self-made shanks or knives, as well as a pipe hidden in his cell. It was during this resentencing hearing that Michael apologized to Jamie and his family for the very first time, and the first time he ever addressed his sister about being on his kill list. Michael told his sister that he was just mad one day, and so that is why he wrote her name down. He said he loved her. The prosecutor, Gail Levine, put Michael on blast, and I was there for it. She was the one who asked him if he had ever even spoken to his sister about this. When he said no, she said, well, here's your chance. She's sitting right here. So I don't know if he would have ever even apologized to his sister had the prosecutor not prompted him to do so.
Well, and he had so meticulously laid out all of his plans and everything in his little notebook that to just be mad one day and put her name on the piece of paper, that doesn't track.
No, because he had all this time to then remove it.
Yeah.
Again, baloney.
And very clearly shows that he's not being truthful. He's still willing to lie.
And that he had no remorse. This is now years later. I think the resentencing hearing was 12 years later. He had 12 years to apologize to his sister. And he said, oh, well, my legal advice was to not talk about it with her.
If you felt remorse, he would have found a way to talk to her.
You would have.
Even through his lawyer, he could have talked to her.
Right. Oh, he had talked to her, but he was just advised not to talk about it. His family stays by his side.
Even his sister.
I believe so.
Wow.
The prosecutor, Gail Levine, also called him out on his fake crying and said she didn't see him wipe his eyes or nose during his so-called apology. She really gave it to him, and it was great. After the three-day hearing, Jamie's parents spoke about how difficult it was to sit through all the details again of their son's murder. George actually had to step out of the courtroom at one point. Regardless of how hard it was, they were determined to show up for their son. George said that all they wanted was to know that Michael was remorseful and sorry for what he did. But sadly, they didn't get that. No one believed that Michael was sorry. He just wanted to get out of prison. Michael said during the hearing that he wanted to get married and have a family and a career in law. Well, Michael, I am sure Jamie would have loved to have had all those opportunities too.
It's all about him.
It is, totally.
Wow.
I don't believe for one second that he was sorry.
I want to get out of prison and try to make amends. I want to do something worthwhile with my life that will make Jamie's death meaningful.
No, I want to get married. I want to have kids. I want to have a career.
Wow. That is selfish.
Yeah, it definitely was. Thankfully, his life sentence was upheld, which I totally agree with. There was no world where Michael could be released and not go on to kill someone else. Michael was not deterred, however, and continued to file appeals. Despite apologizing to Jamie's family, Michael felt zero guilt over his actions and didn't think he should have to spend the rest of his life behind bars. He thought he should have the possibility of parole after 25 years, when he would still be under the age of 40. However, in a twist of fate, the universe took care of the possibility of Michael getting out of parole into its own hands. On April 29, 2021, when Michael was just 31 years old, he suddenly dropped dead inside his jail cell.
They don't know what caused it?
They do. His autopsy revealed that he died from, quote, cardiac dysrhythmia attributed to morbid obesity. I will note that some believe drugs might have been a factor, but I could not find any evidence to support that.
That is an interesting cause of death, Christy.
Yes. People can speculate whatever they want over that. Michael's father had passed away the year prior, so his mom and sister had to go to identify Michael's body. You might think that parents whose child was murdered might celebrate and jump for joy to learn that their child's killer was dead. But that wasn't the case for the Goffs. They are beyond amazing. George stated about Michael's passing, quote, "That was very shocking for us. We were not expecting that at all. We've been hurt. We don't want to see anyone die or hurt like that. Even though we went through what we went through, we were not happy to hear that Michael Hernandez was dead in jail." Jamie's mother, Maria, stated, quote, "I started crying, crying, crying. I wouldn't stop crying. It was very sad." This beautiful couple were able to see past themselves and offered condolences to Michael's parents, Jesus and Kathy.
We got to think that they would have been friends with each other.
They would have been.
If their boys were friends, they would have known each other too.
It's true. And it's just remarkable to me that the Goffs were able to look past themselves and realize how hurtful this would have been for Michael's family too. About Michael's parents, George said, quote, "I don't know how they're going to handle it. I just hope that God gives them the strength to go through every hour and embrace themselves." Directed to Kathy and Jesus, George said, quote, "To the family, I am very sorry this has happened to your son. Mrs. and Mr. Hernandez, we are not happy to hear that your son passed. Despite of all what we have been through, we as parents know how it feels." And I just thought that was really beautiful. I can only imagine the feelings that this would have brought up for Jamie's parents. They said it had made them reflect where their own son would be today had he not been killed. George said, quote, "I envisioned him like professional, probably with family already, so many things. And so when we got the news yesterday, everything came back." Maria said, quote, "Always I think of my son every day, and I have hope in my mind, in my heart, that I'm going to see him one day." They said they rely on their faith to get them through their pain, and I honestly wish them so much healing and love.
What compassionate people.
They're incredible. I can definitely see where Jamie got his sweetness and his kind nature from. Before we end, I want to share with you one more update. Andre Martin, Michael's other intended victim, on February 3rd, 2004, has spoken out about his experience and how everything has motivated him to be the person he is today. He is now in his 30s. Not long after the murder, Andre became involved in martial arts. He worked his way up to a fourth-degree black belt in Taekwondo. He said this discipline helped him cope with his feelings. This would have been so hard for a 13-year-old to process. Andre remembers vividly how the police handled the situation when Jamie was murdered, and he was also on the kill list. He speaks about how kind the officers were to him and said that the way they treated him inspired him to become a police officer himself so that he could also help others. He said, quote, "It absolutely pushed me towards law enforcement, seeing how the detectives protected me and my identity and handled the case." Andre also stated about the police department, quote, "The department has always been there for me, so I'm glad I have the opportunity to pay it forward to the community. He truly wants to help others." Andre's mentor, Bill Hellman, said about Andre, quote, "He took the tragedy that happened and used it as fuel. I think he's got all the tools to be a great cop. He's polished, poised, and humble." And honestly, I agree with this description of Andre so much. Every video I watched of him shows him as this type of man. Andre met Bill Hellman during Michael's 2016 resentencing hearing, and it was after that he pursued his path of becoming an officer. Andre was born in Brooklyn and then moved to Florida at the age of 8. He met and became friends with Michael in grade 3, and the two became best friends. Andre doesn't believe he is a victim. He never wanted to give Michael the power of him being his victim. But he does know that Michael was planning to kill him that day along with Jamie. I think it is remarkable that he took such a horrible experience and allowed it to motivate himself into doing good and didn't use it as an excuse to do worse. As far as I know, he is married, or at least engaged, and has the cutest daughter you ever did see. He is now a detective with Miami-Dade County. In 2018, a street in Palmetto Bay, where everything happened, was named Jamie Goff Way. Andre showed up for his friend and was present at the ceremony. And that is the story of a boy who viciously murdered one of his best friends and never felt bad about it. The teenage dirtbag who wanted to kill as many people as he could, Michael Hernandez.
I totally agree with you, Christy, that I don't think he can reform.
No, I don't think he could have.
It'll be interesting to see what our listeners think about this one as well.
Yes, please let us know. Go to our social medias. Let us know what you think. And give us a like or a follow wherever you're listening. We do appreciate it.
And we'll be back next week
when Melissa has another case.
Until then,
see ya.
Bye. I must tell you that this is like super trippy for my brain.
This is Melissa's first time recording on her computer. We'll see how this goes. We thought maybe my computer was dying.
Really, it's our microphones that are dying.
Yeah, maybe.
We need to run a fundraiser.
We do. We need new equipment, you guys. He didn't like things left out.
Hello.
Hello. Is anybody out there?
Okay, I'll get a drink too then of my
creamy chocolate chill.
No, I can't say that,
no,
can I?
No.
Never mind. Okay. Scratch all that. Did we hear Miss Ghosty today? That'll be the interesting thing.
We'll see what she has to say.
We are always on the same wavelength.
We are.
You know what I think is funny about our relationship is that you're the one that's always about the supernatural. And I'm like, no, that can't happen. But I'm scared. Comes to like movies and stuff like that.
That's true.
Spend time with you, and then my mind goes on hyper overactive drive.
We're a perfect match. What is happening today? Cardiac dysrhythmia attributed to. I feel like this is a hot mess. This episode. We'll see how it is.
Hey, we're live, pal, and we'd love for you to come check out our podcast, Tales from the Estate. Each week, we talk about our top five favorite somethings. My beautiful wife, Caitlin, likes to share all sorts of random facts.
Yeah, did you know that cows have accents?
We did now. But we also review all sorts of snacks and other great things. And so if you love everything random, I think you'd enjoy Tales from the Estate. So come check us out.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Jeff Woods, and I'm shining a light on music and the rock stars who make it.
He just was one of those people. He stood out.
He was a magic guy. He really was a magic guy. We all have force. He had the same amount of force as we all have.
This was before Led Zeppelin. Robert was full on. I mean, he was Led Zeppelin without the band behind him. He had the hair, the jeans, the whole thing, you know, and he was amazing.
The Records and Rockstars podcast, heard around the world and yours to hear wherever you get podcasts. All the episodes from JeffWoodsRadio.com.
Another Sound Off Media Company podcast.